that long ago, actually. I did that Russian one.
The
one where he went home to see his mum.
Ballad of a Soldier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was maybe
3 or 4 ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so pretty recent. Before that, I remembered the other one I did, but yeah, it was Ran. No, not Ran.
Rashomon.
Rashomon.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, I suppose get into it now.
Yes.
Sweet. Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen is sitting on the couch in the corner. May hear from her?
I'll try and keep out of this.
And we are joined once again by our good friend Eric.
G'day.
And we're here to talk about the 2000 film by Steven Soderbergh, Traffic. But before we get into that, it is number 151.
Oh, okay.
Which means Eric needs to sit quietly in the corner for a minute.
You didn't tell me this.
While we look back at the last 10 and give our votes for best and the worst of the last 10.
Alrighty.
So I'll quickly pull up the list and reel them off. So we have Children of Paradise, The Last Wave, The Obscure Object of Desire, Loves of a Blonde, The Fireman's Ball, The Cranes Are Flying, In the Mood for Love, Ballad of a Soldier, Juliet of the Spirits, and Bob Le Flambe Bleu.
We had a whole bunch of really good ones.
Yes, we did.
I'm going to have to pull up images on my phone so I can remind myself of where we are at.
Yeah, yeah. Just thinking back, it was like Children of Paradise seemed like so long ago.
Yeah, well, because we're doing the fortnightly now, it's
kind of spreading them out a little bit more.
It takes ages to find the numbers now because we're like so far into it.
Scroll.
Actually down the bottom of the list. Well, not the bottom.
Like the...
No.
The tenth of the way there.
Yeah, you get
fuck a big list.
And how big's the list these days?
Nearly 900.
Oh, hell.
Will we ever catch up at this rate?
I think you did the math early on where it's like we'll catch up in like 38 years or something.
But that's when we were doing one a week.
Yeah.
So
76 years.
Pretty sure when you're retired, you'd be able to up your rate again.
Probably.
So you can get old David Stratton on this and...
And just absolutely crush it.
Just go to town at 3 in a day.
Yeah. And we can, we do a couple of, like, double features in the box sets, so you never know.
I don't know if I want to pick a worst this time.
It's kind of hard, right? It's a solid block.
There's nothing that I actually...
Disliked.
I was going to say hated, but that's a nicer, nice way to put it.
Less hard.
So I'm not going to give a worse.
Well, do you have a favourite then you could throw out?
I am going to go for The Cranes Are Flying.
Yep.
As my favourite. Only because I absolutely adored all of the visual storytelling. And I was not bored, and I was moved to tears at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only film that did that. This past 10. I gotta admit that I don't actually... Not many films get me like that, but...
Yeah.
It was just a beautiful anti-war story.
Yeah.
That surprised me, being that it's a Russian film.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that Russians are not totally fucked up people.
Yeah. Well, I was debating giving mine to that, but I think I'm gonna give it to In the Mood for Love. Just because that was such a masterpiece of cinematic storytelling and... A beautiful kind of romance without romance story, and yeah, I just really like that movie.
But again, that one was also really key on with the visual storytelling as well. So I think we're both gravitating towards that style, and that's what we want to see.
Mm.
Both great movies,
which could be a wonderful segue into this week's film, Traffic.
Mm.
Not hand-fisted at all.
So yeah, we do a synopsis. I think to put it simply, it is a cross section of the war on drugs in the United States and Mexico. And that's really the meat and bones of it. Well, the bones.
Yeah, and kind of within that you've got the three or four different kind of storylines that all kind of end up weaving together in some way or another.
Mm.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we have a storyline that follows the trial of a drug kingpin from the States, a storyline of the government working against the war on drugs or for the war on drugs, and the daughter of Michael Douglas, who is the drug czar of America, being a drug addicted drug user, and the Mexico police force, or at least
Benicio del Toro.
Yeah. Javier Rodriguez.
Yeah, good one. So is that all of them? That's all the stories?
Yeah, I think, but like within those individual ones, like, I mean,
they're the main ones, but like, you have...
Yeah, with the trial of the drug kingpin, within that you've got the story of, you know, Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman, like, you've got all these characters. I think, I had it for the trivia, but it's something ridiculous, like, there's 135 speaking parts in this film. Like, it is a massive ensemble with so many different characters in.
Yeah, it's a very stories. Extremely well-written, overlapping story.
Yeah.
Like, it's just sort of more one big story.
And the way it's handled and kind of cut together and the flow of it, and you never get lost really with it, or like confused, and you're just like, yep, cool. You follow everything and you like never forget people's names, where you are, what's going on. It's great.
Well, some things I did kind of confuse me slightly. Mainly just motivations between some of the characters, especially Del Toro's character. I found sometimes I was like, oh, is he doing this for this reason or that reason? But then, you know, you only got to watch 5 or 10 minutes and eventually you're like, oh, of course, this is what's happening.
But I'm wondering if that's a purposeful storytelling tactic from Steven Gagan and Soderbergh with the film, where it leaves you kind of curious where they're going, and then, you know, they don't leave you dangling for too long, and then you do eventually. It's like the payoff before the setup, I guess.
And it's definitely a film where you listening to the dialogue helps a lot. Like, we spoke over it a little bit, and like, if you speak over some bits, all of a sudden you miss motivations. You can pick them up quite quickly, but if you watched it on your own in silence, you'd probably follow it slightly more easily.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've been watching Robin Hood Men in Tights. You can talk over that and you don't miss anything. to follow the plot, because there are so many characters. There's so many speaking parts, and it's not as though you're following very split, distinct storylines. They all sort of merge together to form this one big picture, and that is pretty much, what is the war on drugs? Like, the whole thing is, it's not black and white.
Yeah.
Which is, at a government level, you try and make it black and white, but is it such a thing?
Which is illustrated so perfectly, I think, with the arc that Michael Douglas's character takes in the film. Yeah. Like, that's, I think... I mean, Benicio, to some degree, has that similar kind of arc of learning, not necessarily the futility or, like, the grayness of what it is, but it's really, I think, Michael Douglas's character is the one that hammers home that point. He's the one that has, I think, the strongest and all clearest arc, I think.
Yeah, he offers a resolve.
Yeah.
More than anyone else.
He transforms a lot as a character. Yeah, he goes in here with a very black and white view on, I'm stepping into a high role in government to win the war on drugs.
Yeah.
We're going to get a final result. And his predecessor basically tells him straight away, there is no final result.
Yeah, like, what are you talking about, dude?
Yeah, come on, man. And
you're here for 2 years, you're going to do nothing.
Yeah, it's an ongoing thing. Whereas Benicio, very early on, already there's... him and his partner make that bust on the delivery truck just in the middle of the desert, and those guys try to bribe him. Like, they already live in a system where bribing police is just, like, commonplace.
Yeah.
And so they already live in a much greyer world. Or yellow world, once we get talk about the colour filters, but we'll get to that, I'm sure. But yeah, so I guess Benicio's character, he already knows a more split world, and even it's still a lot of learning for him too.
Yeah. But it's interesting, like, jumping to that bribe aspect that, and, you know, the world that he lives in, it's so interesting that it's set up with that scene with the drug bust, and then, you know, contrasted wonderfully with the scene of the dumb American tourists having to be thrown into that system, and him having to explain that, pretty much explain that system to the audience, pretty much.
Yes.
And his kind of reluctance to be a part of it as well. It's like, just, okay, cool, that's who that character is, immediately set up for us.
Yeah. going, I guess, back to Michael Douglas's character and his daughter... So she's a very well-off private school girl, of course, captain of her class, etc., 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 etc. Straight away, she's into pretty heavy drug use. Like, she's not just toking some marijuana, like, I don't know, she's like boiling down cocaine and just inhaling it and passing out, and then Topher Grace is taking advantage of her in like the third scene of the film.
Yeah.
Like, you don't sort of go down this, the chain, she's already fairly deep down the spiral.
Yeah.
Like,
she's on her journey down.
She's on her journey, yeah. It's not like this innocent girl just like, oh, I'll try the marijuana at the party. Like, she did that years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's what's interesting. Like, you find out later, like, this has been going on for, like, at least 6 months. Like, that's all. That's how long the mother has known about it, at least.
Yes, so, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, like, jumping in, not being given that stereotypical, like, oh, the slow descent into drug use. It's like, no, she's fucking well there.
She's there.
Yeah.
I don't think you could have a story where you have to sit through the situation where she's going to a party and having her first, you know, beer, or she's having her first, you know, joint or whatever.
This movie would be 28 days long at that point.
You don't need that. And I mean, I really, like, I don't know, like, these days, weed isn't really a part of the war on drugs anymore.
No,
so.
So you just gotta skip that part.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Starting her story like that would indicate that it's something new that you can fall into. Starting it the way they did was a brilliant way to set up the fact that it's commonplace and it's already...
It's very normalised.
And it's very normalised. It's what these kids are clearly just hanging out after school. And their parents are never home.
Mm.
Yep.
You know, that half the time they're still in their school uniforms.
Mm.
I think it... I was also wondering if it is just how we're thrown in with her narrative and there's no real development of it. Is because it's not necessarily her story, but... her struggle and her what she's going through as a character is there to help inform and grow the arc of Douglas as a character.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we all just sat there just feeling sorry for her.
Yeah.
As it did show some Requiem for a Dream-esque descent.
Yeah.
And Michael Doug, when he first sort of found out, his first reaction was, just ground her, school activities only.
Yeah.
And we're all just like, that's not going to work, man.
Yeah.
That might have worked, like, years ago. But and that's the whole point, isn't it? Like, it's to show...
the oblivious nature of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, my daughter could never be a drug user. And you're like, well, yeah, she could be.
And she really, really is.
Yeah. And it's to show how complex the war on drugs is.
Hmm.
And they never even really touch on the lower socioeconomic stuff in America.
No.
Topher Grace makes a mention of, like, how much money that those neighbourhoods can make quickly and why there's no need to become a law student.
But he comes off as a smug dick while doing it.
He has a punchable face.
Well, his hypocrisy is interesting because he's the first example of... people taking advantage of, what is her name?
Caroline.
Caroline. In the same way that the men do at the end.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. Setting her up to use her for sex.
Yeah.
Like, his hypocrisy is very interesting like that.
And we were commenting, so you never see him ever use drugs. Ever. He gives her drugs early. He's at the party where their friend has a seizure. He never uses. He just spouts philosophical drivel.
Yeah. He's very clearly super high, but you very clearly never see him do it.
Yeah, but you never actually see him use.
He's in so much more control.
The first moment you see him, he snorts like a line of coke. But
oh, that's true.
But he's
not.
And he has a weird way of holding.
Yeah, but he's not on her level.
Yeah,
no, they don't paint him as like a constant user.
Yeah,
like,
well, I mean, case in point that Michael Douglas—he's actually in school when Michael Douglas has to go and drag him out.
Yeah, that's the difference. Is it? Yeah, like I said, he's always in control.
Mm. Yep.
And he always controls what Caroline's doing.
Yep.
He feeds it to her first.
What an asshole.
Yeah.
But he plays it so well.
He nails it.
Yeah. He really does.
He doesn't get much screen time and you know exactly what character it is.
Yeah.
Like, he's very well done.
God damn. Well, I guess, like, we're really kind of concentrating on the Washington-Cincinnati storyline at the moment.
Yep.
Do we want to kind of break this down by... kind of like story by story and kind of nut out this one first and then we'll move on to the next?
Or
I'm sure it's going to ebb and flow as the films and the narrative does, but
I think it's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Talk about the interconnectivity.
It's an odd one where I kind of connect weirdly with this story. Like, I find this one probably the most engaging of them all, and I think that's because it is the most human story of them all.
So Douglas's
yeah.
story?
Yeah. That's the one, like, it doesn't have necessarily, like, you know, it's not a film that has action or intrigue, really. But
no,
it's,
no.
But it's the one I seem to kind of connect with more, and I think that's because it is just a very raw human
and it
emotional
happens
story.
In the home. Like, yes. The phrase closer to home, it's that's what it focuses on.
Yeah, yeah.
Other ones you get how, like, Don Cheadle and his partner, and you see a few other ones like Del Toro and his partner and things like that. But that's in the workplace. This is even closer.
Yeah, and it's the
family. Like,
yeah. So
not to say the other ones aren't emotional too, but...
Yeah. It's the one, like, I hadn't seen this film in years, but it's the one that, like, the storyline that I remembered the clearest was that whole descent and that issue that he's going through. I think it is because, yeah, like you were saying, it makes, you know, bring it into the family and the home and everything makes you connect with it, I guess. Mm.
A nod from Tom.
I don't know if you can tackle this film talking about like a laundry list of stories.
Yeah,
I think that's very hard to do.
Yeah, and I don't know if we want to do that because, I mean, it's literally just a list.
Yeah,
yeah, at that point. Which is...
So let's just say that some of the stories are there to aid, like, understanding the logistics of dealing with the war on drugs. On an institutional level, and that the real front is the most engaging front, which is like
the home.
How the families are affected by it, right?
Yeah, and the individuals, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it just shows how complex the big picture is. It is, there's home level, there is literally logistical level of getting across the American border, and they talk about how, like, heaps get stopped, but heaps get through.
Yeah, it's, He said, what's the statistic he gives? Like, we would want to be doing 70 to 80%, but realistically, we're getting 30 to 40, so...
Yeah, just a huge amount gets through. So there's just the logistics. There's the supply and demand. And they say, he's talking about the budget difference between the American the Mexican cartels and the American government. And they're like, so what, you're saying they've got more budget than us? Like, yeah, it's limitless for them.
Yeah, it's a zero-sum game. It's like, yeah. No.
We will never have as much money ever as the Mexican cartels have, the suppliers have, to keep pushing it.
Yeah.
So on an operational level, you get that as well. So yeah, it shows each level of trying to stop it. It's so complicated.
Mm.
You get a sense that it's completely hopeless.
Well, yeah.
Like, there's absolutely nothing that any institution can do because it's just too lucrative on the other side.
Yeah, and then you're left with the question, do you just stop? But then you're like, well, then it opens all the floodgates and it probably just gets worse, surely.
Yeah.
But I think the film's success is that it transitions from a logistical nightmare to being a problem between humans. Yeah. And, for example, like Michael Douglas's character effectively just leaves his job so that he can handle the problems in his own house.
Yeah.
Thereby doing, effectively winning, in a sense, the war on drugs. Not on a national level, but
on a
definitely on a, you know, what really matters is, like, your direct family and the people you communicate with. So, I don't know, like, the film offers some, like, a pretty damn good resolution to the problem.
Mm.
Mm.
Without reducing it to, we just need to throw, you know, more money at the problems.
Yeah, more police, yeah.
And it ends on such a, yeah, positive, what interesting note in that what you were saying, how it is that it's just a futile kind of battle and things. And the film kind of very much in the third act deals with that of, you know, the money issue or, I mean, the Miguel Ferreira's character, the witness who's going to testify, just telling Don Cheadle, like, you essentially work for a drug dealer right now because you are helping the other drug dealer by getting me out of
by
the way.
By bringing down my drug dealer.
Yeah, so it's that, funny. Like, the futility of it all, yet the film... Like, then that's right, kind of, the third act, like, where we're kind of, it's leaving, and you're like, oh, what the, like, this is kind of depressing and brutal. But it does a wonderful thing where it adds these wonderful little moments of hope with Michael Douglas sitting at the NA meeting with his daughter, Don Cheadle deciding, like, no, it is worth it, and continuing on with the work, and sneakily planting the microphone and being happy, super stoked about that. And then, I mean, I think the wonderful ending with Benicio del Toro at the baseball game, watching the kids play, and that kind of ties back to that wonderful little speech he gave earlier in the film about, you know, making it all worthwhile, making it a wonderful place. Why you do the job is so kids can play safely at night. And it's like, yeah it's That's why he gives that nice little smile. It's just like, has he made the good choices as a character? And you just like, just show him enjoying the kids playing baseball. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's a wonderful little
ending.
Yeah,
true. But then, like, but you look at the story between Catherine Zeta-Jones and, like, what's his name? The dude that runs
The American division. Carl was her husband. Stephen Bauer.
So he's just, you know, he got acquitted because, you know...
The main
dude was shot, the testifying guy.
Yep, he died.
And, you know, everything's just back to normal, and it's back in this cycle of you got to throw money at the problem again. So...
This is the one storyline where I get that it's there to, you know, you have to show the spectrum of the lives affected and, like, how people... what this world is. But it's the one where, like... she just descends so quickly into her life.
Yeah, she does transform fast. So she... originally, she complains very quickly that she just wants her old life back, which is rich and easy. Even though she doesn't come across as hateable, really.
No.
She's not painted as that kind
of... she comes across as a caring mother. Like, that's what you think her primary interest is caring for her children. But then that flurs to... maintaining your lifestyle?
It happens very quickly because her son gets threatened because her husband still owes money to the Mexican cartel. And as soon after the son gets threatened, then she just gets real very quickly, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And her husband sort of gives her some tips and she ends up acquitting him so that life can go back to... or helping to arrange the killing of the witness so life can go back to normal for all of them.
Mm.
There was big leaps in her character. For her to go from, I had no idea that my husband did this, to, here, I've got a doll that's made of cocaine and it's going to make everybody a whole bunch of money, let's do this.
But like being on the phone to the assassin, being like, get out of the car and shoot him in the fucking head. It's like, wow, okay.
Because every other character really was so well written and progressed at a really good speed or set up really nicely. Hers was probably... I think for me, she's probably the only one that kind of maybe moved a bit too quickly or transformed, because the others are all done so well.
Yeah,
I think it's probably the way to put it. Hers just maybe stood out a little bit more.
And well, for me as well, I'm just like, what is the I guess the overall point of that storyline is to help emphasize the futility of the war on drugs on a like American legal system standpoint, I guess. Like the ending of that, it's like it's the one that isn't satisfying, and you're like, okay, right.
Yeah. I mean,
she got what she wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know they're going to get fucked in the end.
Yeah, that's true. But...
yeah, seeing the courtroom failing basically shows how ridiculously hard it is to acquit these rich, powerful people who can just hire hitmen, multiple different hitmen.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Is that what the point of this storyline is?
It's to show that the more money and power you have, that how difficult it is to fight against those... when you are using an elected bureaucracy that also has to do all sorts of other stuff.
Mm. Well, it's kind of, I guess, showing the giant spectrum of the war on drugs across all legal spectrums. You've got the police officers, the DEA, the head of governments with the drug czar, and even the court system, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, speaking to a character like that, you talk about, like, the big change in her character to go from, like, unknowing mother to screaming at a hitman to just get out. I do think that there might be something there. I mean, you watch her at the beginning when she's having lunch and it's so...
yeah, she's a bit vapid. Yep.
It's so false, it's so vain, it's so selfish. It's a very selfish lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the point of that story and that character was to sort of highlight how far people can get lost in selfishness thanks to having money.
So do you reckon maybe if she was...
nobody else mattered.
...acted differently or had a bit more screen time to actually build up that character being a bit more vapid, that would have made her character evolution stronger?
I actually think the point of it was how easy that transition happened, that you didn't even notice that it was a transition. It's not like Michael Douglas where you watch him slowly learn the things he needs to learn to wake him up.
Mm.
The point of her character was that she was always capable of it.
Yeah.
Because she lived in a social hierarchy that where, was really cold.
And people don't really matter to her anyway.
Mm. Yeah, she was in the
1%. Except her family and her money and her home and her status.
Yep.
So I think maybe that was the point, is that it was so easy for her to do that and it didn't change her character at all. She was the same person from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, okay. It's just that...
It's not so far-fetched. But no, there's still a stretch. A little bit of a stretch.
Oh, yeah, there is. But I think, like, you know, it's probably a little bit exaggerated in her character to make that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I reckon that's probably not too... Yeah. I like that. I think maybe one or two more scenes. Or I wonder if maybe if she was cast or acted slightly differently, that might have carried across a bit more. Not saying she did a bad job acting, but I wonder if, yeah, for that, maybe that could have actually made that a little clearer.
She is given the least amount of screen time out of all those stories. Yeah.
She maybe did it a little bit more.
Maybe one or two scenes. Like, I mean, the transition scene we get of her really is her lying in bed, thinking back to talking with her husband in prison, then just finding the hitman's information and stuff, and being like, okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm going to hire the assassin.
Like, you get literally a 15-second scene of her lying in bed going, huh.
I guess I could kill that guy.
Yeah.
I can directly murder people if I want.
Yeah, so maybe like one or two little things, like adding.
Well, when did the scene happen with Dennis Quaid in the office? Because that's the first indication of how quickly she can play people.
That was after her son got threatened, directly after, because she was asking him about the money, if they had $3 million that they needed to pay off the cartel. And he was like, no.
Yeah, so even before she starts thinking of ideas of getting involved in the husband's business, she's already playing people.
Yeah.
She's already making
moves. A
bit
manipulative. Yeah.
Because that was not subtle.
No.
Good old Dennis Quaid.
His eyebrows went up.
Oh.
He managed to stifle that noise, though.
Yep. Yeah, I guess where do we go now?
Can we talk about the filters?
Mm.
Yeah, okay.
That's like we can maybe just spend a bit of time on that, because obviously the film really loves filters.
Yes.
Really loves different grains of film, and let's explore why.
I think
do that to that degree.
Yeah, because it's very obvious on the surface, but yeah, I think it's good to go deeper into that, particularly.
It's a bit jarring. I mean, the first scenes, it's literally just you're watching orange scale, right? There's nothing but orange. Then it transitions straight to a very saturated blue.
Yeah, so for people who haven't seen it, it's Mexican. The Mexican scene, particularly with Benicio, very orangey-yellow, almost sepia tone, I guess.
Mm.
And a bit grainy, aren't they?
Yeah, so it's...
The particularly Michael Douglas American Washington scenes are very, very blue.
Yes.
And then a lot of others aren't that filtered.
Yeah.
But those are the most jarring ones.
Yeah. What I've got kind of written down is, to basically achieve those different looks, it was using different lenses, filters, and different film stock to achieve a different grain. Like I was saying, the Mexican grain film stock has a very higher grain and distinct, grittier look, and that's to kind of give the rugged and hot kind of atmosphere to it, and real effectively. And the blues adding to the kind of depression and blah, 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 blah. But I think what made Soderbergh decide to do that, I think it's, while, yeah, it works very clearly on a stylistic level, but I think it helps in terms of narrative, actually.
The practical aspect of jumping from scene to scene, from different nation to different nation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. It helps the audience, it's a visual cue for the audience to keep track of where we are, in any particular moment, what this is about, like where...
Yeah, you don't need subtitles anymore if you do that.
Yeah, like it's in the scenes where Benicio is travelling across the border even as well, and same with Michael Douglas, and even when Benicio is in Mexico City, if it wasn't for the filters, it would be hard to tell the difference between necessarily some of the Mexico City versus Cincinnati or Washington.
Because there's a lot of back and forth across the Mexican border.
Yeah.
Between San Diego and Tijuana, pretty much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could definitely say that probably...
I think it wasn't necessarily a visual, like, look how cool this is going to look. It was a, like, actually, this will help people understand, which is a very clever thing to do. And it, you know, obviously adds that cool visual style, but...
And it was definitely jarring at times, though, wasn't it?
Well, I think just initially, because you're like, why is it blue, man? Why is it blue?
Yeah, he didn't hold back. It was quite blue.
It eases up as it goes along, though. Does it, or is it just you getting used to it?
Definitely at the start, I noticed it a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
Then it definitely mellowed, but then every now and then one would really jump out.
Yeah.
Just every now and then one scene would be just really blue again or something like that. So just a couple of standalones, and then others I wouldn't notice much.
I enjoyed that Catherine Zeta-Jones' story starts off as neither. It's very well normally coloured. And in the end, it's full orange.
Yeah, it's quiet.
So it's almost like at the beginning of her story, you kind of go, which way? Like, you don't know where she's going to go. She's sitting in the middle.
Yep.
And by the end of the story, you know which side of the fence she's on.
Yeah, she's gone to the yellow side.
What he's done in that...
I mean, Mexico's bad.
Drugs are bad, okay?
Yeah, with her storyline, it's actually a lot of oversaturated lights coming in from outside and things as well, and primary colours.
Yeah, because it'd be those sorts of subtleties I wouldn't pick up on.
Yeah, that was the kind of key thing for that one.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, when I think of colour saturations to progress the character's change, I think of the movie 13. When she goes down her final spiral. Anyway, totally different film, but it goes totally sepia, doesn't it?
Yeah, like it works as well, because, I mean, it is a drug descent as well.
Yeah, it's a drug descent too, and she progresses, and when she hits rock bottom, like, all colour's gone out of life, and then it all goes happy again.
Yeah.
Colour returns. So it tracks a journey, really, but that's a lot more obvious, because that's just a pure descent. But that's probably the closest thing to the Catherine Zeta-Jones' character I can think of.
Mm.
Mm. Okay, what else?
Well, I thought it's kind of continuing on with the cinematographical kind of aspect of the discussion. I thought it was really interesting that Mexico is all shot handheld. It's never on sticks, and it's never steady. It's always rough, handheld, and very close.
You're very cramped, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always quite up in your face.
Which is... I'm wondering if that's Soderbergh doing it as an approach of, like, oh, we're going to do this rough, rugged, and, like, indie style, like, we don't have a lot of money, kind of helping to represent, that whole aspect, whereas Washington is always, always still, unless it's you're in the slums.
Yeah, yes, Cincinnati. That's true.
Then it's also on handheld.
And I think, maybe it represents, like, because Michael Douglas's characters kind of at least starts with a very ordered approach, like we're saying, the black and white, let's beat the war on drugs kind of thing. And yeah, maybe that's why he's got really steady shots. And then Mexico, from the word go, it's about bribes. And it's a very different world, so they're probably... match that. But then, yes, they do have, as you're going through the slums to find Carolyn's dealer,
that's when it goes handheld.
It goes handheld. It's very different.
Yeah, but even, like, just remembering as well, like, Michael Douglas, when he visits Mexico, it's not gone to handheld. It's very...
True, that's Americans in sterile environments, yes. Meeting officials.
Yes, so it's a reflect... The camera's a reflection of, I guess, the characters and the situations they are.
Is it meant to reflect the streets, the street gritty thing, versus the office view of the war on drugs?
I guess, to some degree.
Yeah, Michael Douglas, basically by the end, is sort of, his final line is, I'm here to listen.
Yeah.
To his daughter, which is really sweet.
Yeah. I got a little lump in my throat when you said that.
Oh, did you?
Sweet, man.
Finally.
Yeah.
I think it's just trying to set a mood. It's trying to, like, by just giving you the shaky cam versus the still shots, it's just letting you step slightly, even just subconsciously, into the mindsets of whoever's on screen at the time. It's pretty simple. It's a pretty simple thing to do, but, like, do it because it works.
And it was executed really well. Like, for me, I had no issue. I felt really immersed.
Yeah.
And I just like it, because the movie, like, it's very hard to summate. It jumps all over the place, I guess, in a way, between characters and locations, and still manages to, you can track it relatively easily.
Mm.
And I had no issues following it, despite all these filters and camera, it worked.
Yeah. Do you guys want to talk about performances a little bit?
Which ones?
Which would be 135?
Yeah, I know, yeah. Let's...
I guess we'll kind of...
Did anyone have a favourite?
Yeah, is there a standout?
And, like, we all love Luis Guzman, so we could just say that, but, like, did anyone actually have a favourite performance?
Del
Toro.
I mean, it goes without saying that Benicio Del Toro's incredible in this film.
Yeah, he's just all over it, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's an oddly subdued performance, I think. Like, he's...
Yeah.
he's doing so much without doing a whole lot.
He's a character, yeah, he achieves a lot through the movie.
Yeah.
He's obviously very thoughtful. His partner's girlfriend keeps coming to him, and he never has to say or do much.
Yeah.
But he just seems in control.
He's
just
a really nuanced face work.
Yeah, he's very so emotive that you're just like, that's Del Toro doing what he do.
You can see so much going on, like, ticking over in his head, like, from scene to scene. Things, like, keep moving in that Mexico story so quickly.
Mm.
Without and actually being verbalised.
Yeah, and you can see him keeping up and keeping steps ahead all the time, and he never says anything.
Yeah. God damn. I love that man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, and we kind of brought it up while watching it, but I wonder if it is a product of having worked together before in P.T. Anderson films, but Luis Guzman and Don Cheadle, their relationship is...
They're a pair.
So charming.
Yeah, like, they... Yeah. They look like they've been working together for a long time as DEA
agents.
They
felt real, didn't they?
They felt really real. Yeah, their chats in the back of the van and stuff, and it didn't feel fake or put on.
Mm.
Yeah. But then also just the kind of bitter nature Cheadle has towards Miguel Ferreira's character, the witness, and things. Just like the little moments with Cheadle, I think. I thought he was wonderful in the movie.
I thought Miguel was really good.
Yeah.
For a guy with a relatively small role.
As
a performer, I thought he did a really good job, just his little bits and his little, that final spiel he had before he choked on his food and drugs or whatever.
Yeah.
about how the war is pointless, like, in a way. He's like, you know, your partner would still be alive, you know?
Yeah, and people would be getting high who were going to be getting higher anyway, like, yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Well, so there's like all these, actors in this film that later became really, really recognized as really, really good actors.
Yeah, like Viola Davis as the social worker.
Yeah,
John Slattery from Mad Men in a small role.
All these little minute roles.
What's the assassin's name?
Oh, Clifton Collins is the assassin.
He was such a small character, but actually, kudos to his performance if you actually really stop and think about all the scenes with him.
God,
watching him getting tortured, for example.
No, the scene after he was tortured, when he's like, they open the door and he just cowers. Oh God, it's so powerful.
And then even sitting at the table with the general and he's talking about stereos and he's got still so much passion but he's still like shitting himself.
Yeah.
And then like cuts to the end and he's like sassy.
Sassy gay hitman again.
He's so suave.
His range is definitely on display there.
Yeah. This has to be like one of the most solid ensembles ever, like compiled on screen.
Who's responsible for casting?
Who is responsible for casting? Deborah Zane.
Good on you, Deb.
You did your job real well.
Yeah, you nailed it. Yeah.
I think she actually won an award for it. This is one, like the Screen Actors Guild, at their awards, they give out, the award for, you know, best actor, best actress and all that, but they also give out ensemble awards.
Yeah.
And that includes the casting director.
Yeah.
Which is like, well done.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Albert Finney, James Brolin's in this movie. Like, so many fucking people.
Salma Hayek, of course, is in there for like a
minute. One scene! Oh, yeah.
Just one quick scene.
And I was thinking while watching it, like, is this, like, early on for her? And I'm like, no, this is, like, post Wild Wild West and Dogma. Like, she's blown up by this point.
She's done Hollywood and stuff already.
Yeah.
I wonder if a lot of actors just wanted to be a part of it, and so they're just like, yeah, I'll do it for, you know, little to no money. And
how do you get that ball rolling, though? I mean, I know Soderbergh's already, you know.
Well, this, like, I'll look at, like, Soderbergh obviously had kind of made a huge, huge splash with, Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 89, but that was like a very huge indie hit. But then he kind of went off and was doing little weird, bizarre films for a long time. Things like Kafka, King of the Hill, and like the super weird Schizopolis, which he stars in. It's like fucking weird. Great movie.
I'll trust you on that.
Oh, good.
But this is, I mean, he'd kind of built himself back up, like, not up that he had to, but like had come into the mainstream with Out of Sight, which was an amazing film and a huge movie. So I guess it was just a bunch of actors being, like, you know, a chance to work with in a massive ensemble with a really good director on material that is really good.
And they're all really good actors. There's no gimmicky actors, or it's not a collection of... ones who bounce between blockbusters and then making a good one. I mean, you know, like the Brad Pitt who can act up a storm, but then will also go on and do his money makers as well. Yeah. So it wasn't that kind. They were just all just choice actors.
Yeah.
There's just a massive handful of small character actors that together make a really fascinating, cohesive, you know, canvas.
Yep.
I agree. I mean, is there anything else that we... What haven't we kind of talked about?
They didn't use a lot of music.
No.
They didn't need to. But now that I think about it, there were a couple of songs. We recognise one and stuff, but generally they didn't rely on music to drive the emotion in scenes or anything like that.
It was more ambient. There wasn't, like, you know, a musical theme to it. There wasn't the score was basically very tonal.
Yes.
And you would have, like, you know, a bass or, like, you know, little strings. And
there was no, like, I mean, Requiem for a Dream, for example, the incredible theme that...
Same composer.
Well, there you go. He's a drug expert. But, like, the final descent in that film is so powerful because of lots of elements, but the music just drives it so powerful. It didn't need... this movie didn't really have those scenes so much anyway, but it didn't need music to power home.
Yeah.
Perhaps you want it to be more associated with the kind of realistic look. I mean, because you have... Remember that sequence where Michael Douglas's daughter is taking drugs with that black dude, the drug dealer?
Yeah.
And then in the background, there's all this ambient music, ambient sound effects going on, like children playing, birds singing and stuff like that.
And it's the first time she uses heroin.
Yeah, and it's really uneasy and shit. So if you're focusing on sound design like that, as opposed to just giving it some kind of mood with the music, then...
It gives it the realism that it deserves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it made it feel... Well, we all cringed. It feel so real.
It's fucking unsettling.
It's like, oh, Jesus, don't do it. Oh, it's not enough for it.
Well, I mean, anything else, or should I jump into trivia? Or
I don't know. Is there any, like... What's, like... We've talked about the message, right? I mean, it's, like, clear that everyone on board of that film was... The war on drugs is stupid.
It can't be classified as a black and white war with a... Because war, technically, to me, has an outcome. You win or you lose. Like, there is a victory or a loss at the end, theoretically. It's more complicated than that. And that's essentially, I think, what this was saying. The war on drugs is a totally... You don't suddenly just stop all drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't just shut down the cartels and be like, we did it. Like,
there's no more. Ever again.
Yeah.
I mean, remember Prohibition? That worked real well. And that actually, I'll bring that up now. They actually do make mention of it, and it's something that I drink alcohol, and you see in data, alcohol is just a drug that we cannot ban, because it's too easy for people to make. Yeah. Any average person can make alcohol, and that's why Prohibition failed. Alcohol is a drug that's just as bad as so many of those other drugs that are illegal.
Is that why weed's becoming legal more and more these days?
I think so.
It's so easy,
and also I think people are, to me, I don't know, the impact of it is honestly not that different to alcohol's impact on society.
No.
I mean, look at alcoholism, the cost on healthcare, the violence that it creates. Alcohol is a serious drug. It's just one we cannot stop, and it's accepted in society for that reason.
Yeah.
And I drink alcohol, it's nice.
Beer is fucking tasty.
Yeah, it's delicious, and people use it for different reasons. People depend on it. It's an addiction. And the war on drugs, is the difference is it's much harder to synthesize crystal meth than it is to just put some potatoes and water in like a vat and like turn it into vodka. I mean, not that I know how, but I could look it up, and I'm sure I could make some shitty alcohol really easily.
That'll do the job.
Yeah, like I could make it in a bathtub.
Yeah,
and it will get me drunk, and it'll probably make me die younger.
Yeah.
But Michael Douglas...
You will have experienced bathtub vodka.
Which is on the bucket list. But Michael Douglas's character drinks scotch, and his wife even comments at some stage, oh, you know, you need several scotches to get to sleep. He's like, that's different. Like, it's not, mate. It's your own drug.
And also, his reasons for doing it are pretty comparable, too.
Yeah, he says he's... I needed a drink of scotch because... being at home is boring. Well, that's why your daughter's using...
Yeah. She's in the same boring house that you are.
Like, she's using a different drug, so...
So you're saying if this family had board game night once a week or something, everything would be fine.
It would help a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Okay. Was it you that pointed out the irony at the... Like, when he's first given the new job and he goes to that party and then everyone's just, like, cornering him and talking to him about, like... You know, their opinion on the war on drugs, and you're just like, everyone in this room is drinking alcohol right
now. Yeah, he goes to the Senator party sort of thing at the White House, and everyone's giving their opinion, and everyone's holding a martini or a champagne or something. Like, you've all got drugs, you realise.
And then I think right when you said that, it had the cutaway where he's like, can I get a scotch?
Yes! And yeah, it's like, it's just, that's the one that is integrated into society and it'll never leave.
Hmm.
So it's just an interesting counterpoint, and the movie does highlight it a little bit. Doesn't focus on it, but it puts it in there.
No.
Makes you think a little bit.
Yeah, but it is, like, yeah, the film is, at the end of the day, just shining a light on the war on drugs in the terms that it is not as black and white as most people perceive it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well done, Soderbergh.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
Mm. So we'll move on to trivia at that point. Yeah, so the film was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, and it won 4 of them. It won Best Supporting Actor for Benicio Del Toro. Best Director for Steven Soderbergh. He actually beat himself. He was nominated against himself in that category.
What was the other film?
In the same year he made this, he made Aaron Brockovich.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So he directed 2 films that were nominated for Best Picture and Best Director in the same year.
Jeez, yeah, right.
That's fucking nuts. How do you even manage that?
I don't know. Especially a film that is this complex. Like,
yeah.
This one's so complex, and Aaron Brockovich is full of so much research.
Yeah, it's not necessarily as complex
visually
or, you know, in a narrative sense, but it is a...
deeply written story.
Yeah, and a very good film.
Well adapted, yeah.
Was he building them in tandem?
I don't know. I
don't see how you could make those two films...
Yeah,
right, back to back in the year.
Yeah. I guess they just released in the same year. That's true. It's technicality.
Well, there's some other weird ones. Like, I know Spielberg directed Schindler's List and Jurassic Park in the same year.
Jesus, yeah, right.
It's just like, what?
You're on a roll.
Yeah, yeah, don't stop.
Yeah,
he was Reaganing.
Oh god, that was the best Dirty Rock reference. Well done.
Couldn't help myself.
Yeah. So it also won Best Adapted Screenplay for Stephen Gagan. It is actually based off of a British miniseries aired in 1989 that he's then adapted. And it also won Best Editing. It didn't win Best Picture that year. It also won 2 Golden Globes, Best Supporting Actor and Best Screenplay. Was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress for Catherine Zeta-Jones. Similarly, it won the BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor... Benicio won every award.
Yeah.
Was also nominated for the BAFTA. Also won Best Screenplay at the BAFTA and was nominated for Editing and Directing. Screen Actors Guild awarded Benicio for Best Supporting Actor, and the entire cast, as I previously mentioned, won the award for Ensemble in a Motion Picture. Del Toro even won the Silver Bear at the Berlin Film Festival for Best Actor. While the National Board of Review named Soderbergh Best Director and listed the film as a top 10 of the year. So it was a very lauded film.
It did well. Good. Yeah, deserved it.
So the film, as we kind of mentioned earlier, has 135 speaking parts, but it was shot in over 110 locations in 8 different cities.
Okay.
Like, that is a hectic...
Imagine being the location scout team.
Let alone, like, just the AD and people on this supervisor, like, oh my god. When a critic commented that it seemed unrealistic that the daughter's high school record was almost perfect when she was taking drugs, screenwriter Stephen Gagan pointed out that the high school record in the film was actually his, and he was actually abusing drugs at the time. It's like, I modeled that after me.
Yep.
Benicio Del Toro is one of only 6 actors to win an Academy Award for speaking a part mainly in a foreign language. Pretty much.
Yeah,
he only
has
1 scene that's in English. Sophia Loren, Robert De Niro, Marion Cotillard, Christoph Waltz, and Roberto Benigni are the other 5.
Who's Roberto Benigni?
Life is Beautiful.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. I always forget De Niro in Godfather 2 is all in Italian. pretty much. Yeah. Like, I forget that.
Yeah.
Mm. The scene where Michael Douglas takes his trip to the California border crossing to discuss drug interdiction, I was actually shot at the Tijuana crossing. The video and sound quality are so low, it's not because he's in Mexico, but, like, the drop in quality, but it's because it was never actually supposed to be part of the movie. Michael Douglas started asking, out of character, Rudy M. Camacho, who was the drug official who was there with them, about drug trafficking on the border. Camacho was, at the time, actually the customs chief in charge of the California border crossing. Steven Soderbergh began filming it with a handheld camera, praying that Camacho wouldn't address him as Mr. Douglas. He was just like, they were just having a conversation. He's like, this is gold.
It was gold. Yeah. It was perfect.
So when he was asking it and gave the statistics about, you know...
That was all accurate statistics.
Yeah, and it was just a conversation that he secretly filmed.
Jeez, that turned out all right. Sweet.
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff of, like, people that were approached to play roles and different people and stuff, and the one kind of one that I could have listed a whole bunch, but it was like trivial trivia.
Yeah.
But the one that I thought was kind of interesting was Michael Douglas originally declined the role of Robert Wakefield, and it was offered to Harrison Ford, who accepted the part. Ford worked with director Steven Soderbergh to improve the character, but then decided to not do the film. Douglas liked the changes that Harrison Ford had made in the character so much that he accepted the new role.
So does Harrison Ford get a credit?
No.
Character was like before.
I would imagine it probably lacked the willingness to learn, or that sounds so blank.
Yeah,
like
who,
I guess,
who knows, like how the fuck
maybe the transformation arc mightn't have been as complete, or
yeah, that's what I feel. It might have been just a simple bureaucratic guy. Oh, my daughter's gone. I need to become vigilante and learn my lesson that way. Whereas you actually see a subtle transition on the job, yeah, of him wanting to learn, like when he goes, like for instance, going to the Tijuana crossing,
yeah,
actually physically going there, and then the plane ride back, where he's like, "This is the floodgates open. Give me any and all." Like it's a willingness
to
learn.
Proactive.
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
I wonder if originally he was ever meant to have been the person to like put his coat on and go out of the house and go look for the daughter.
Yeah, it could have been the wife.
I wonder if it was just like his story, and like the daughter goes down, and the daughter gets brought back.
Yeah,
and he just happens to be along with.
It's such a predominant part of that story, yeah, that I would imagine that would be the thing that would be there.
Unless Topher Grace's character was initially more supportive, perhaps, and then they wrote him into more of a jerk. Maybe he
possibly
was. Who knows?
Yeah,
be interesting.
But yeah, you're just kind of thinking like Harrison Ford, like working on this role that would have been real interesting, I think.
Mm.
But yeah, that about wraps it up for the trivia on Traffic. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. So the film is still available from Criterion as a one-disc Blu-ray or a two-disc DVD. And it comes with the special features of three audio commentaries. The first featuring Soderbergh and writer Steven Gagan. The second with producers Laura Bickford, Edward Zwick, and Marshall Herskowitz. Along with consultants Tim Golden and Craig Chertian. And then a third and final one with composer Cliff Martinez. It also has 25 deleted scenes with optional commentary by Soderbergh and Gagan. Three sets of demonstration. One on the film processing and the look of the Mexican sequences. One on film editing and with commentary by editor Stephen Maroney. And one on the dialogue editing. Additional unused footage of various scenes from multiple angles, theatrical trailers and television spots, and the weirdest thing ever, a gallery of trading cards depicting the US Customs canine squad used to detect narcotics and other illegal substances.
Wow.
Do you reckon that's actually off like the official US website? Is like,
I would imagine, yeah, so, yeah.
Wow.
Can we post that on Twitter?
Yeah, I'll grab them off of the DVD and grab the images and post them online, because that's pretty
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
And it also comes with the usual booklet and essays that Criterion always do.
It's a pretty good collection of features, actually.
It's solid, yeah. Soderbergh has a lot of films through Criterion, so I think he's very helpful with, like,
yeah,
here's everything I got.
Yeah.
Let's break this down.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Who's on the front cover? Is that
There was a painting, I believe.
Is that Clifton? What's his name?
Clifton Collins.
Clifton Collins, is that him?
Possibly, yeah, because he's got the white shirt.
And he did aim the gun up in the air.
Yeah, I've never been sure who that was.
Mm. Yeah. It's a very cool image. I really like that cover art.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I reckon you're right.
Yeah. But yeah, unless you guys have anything else, that'll wrap us up for our episode on traffic.
I do not.
Okay. If you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at @CriterionQuest. Other than that, we will be back in a fortnight's time with George Washington, the David Gordon Green film. So the first film from the guy that went on to direct Pineapple Express.
No shit.
Wow, all right.
And Bunch.
What is that, like a biopic thing?
No, no, it's a little indie film about African-American kids in the slums.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's a really interesting little super indie film. I like it. But yeah, David Gordon Green's an interesting director. He goes like kind of across the board of doing like very studio-based comedy, and then will do weird little indie stuff. All the time. Like, he does, like...
Does it one...
A movie a year kind of thing, and back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, not a bad way.
Yeah. But, yeah, for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Eric.
See you next time. Oh, sorry, Cole, did you want to say bye?
No.
Oh.